Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 179. If you set your goals ridiculously high and fail, you fail above everyone else's successes. James Cameron.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, my Indie Film Hustlers, to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Enigma Elements. As filmmakers, we're always looking for ways to level up production value of our projects and speed up our workflow. This is why I created Enigma Elements, your one-stop shop for film grains, color grading LUTs, vintage analog textures like VHS and CRT images, smoke, fog textures, DaVinci Resolve presets, and much more. After working as an editor, colorist, post, and VFX supervisor for almost 30 years, I know what film creatives need to level up their projects. Check out EnigmaElements.com. And use the coupon code IFH10 to get 10% off your order. I'll be adding new elements all the time. Again, that's Enigma, E-N-I-G-M-A, elements.com.
Today's show is also sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Guys, today is an amazing episode. I'm so excited to bring this episode to you. Today's guest is Oscar-winning and legendary cinematographer Russell Carpenter. Now, if you guys have been under a bridge or under a rock somewhere for the last 30 years, Russell Carpenter is the cinematographer of not only some of the biggest movies of all time, like Marvel's Ant-Man, Triple X, Charlie's Angel, The Negotiator, True Lies, Monster in Law, and some of my favorite 80s and 90s action films, Hard Target, which was John Woo's first American movie, The Perfect Weapon, and Death Warrant. But the one I'm leaving out is probably his largest and biggest movie ever. Actually, the second highest grossing film ever, Titanic. Russell, by far, is one of the sweetest and kindest souls I've ever had the pleasure of talking to. Now, Russell is not only famous for working on Titanic, but also working on just with the most amazing directors and filmmakers over the course of his career, none being probably more prolific than the legendary James Cameron. And Russell and I sit down and talk about almost his entire career, as well as working with James Cameron, how he got the job on True Lies, which is an amazing story, and how he got the job, and then from there, how he got to Titanic, and what was it like working on the biggest movie of all time at the time he was making it. I mean, it was a $200 million movie when nothing was even close to a $200 million movie. To have that kind of scope and to deal with what he was dealing with on a daily basis, all the stories, all the rumors of the project going down and it's going to be a complete catastrophe. And it was just a thing that you can't understand in today's world, what he went through on Titanic and the just the mere size of it all and how he was able to handle that is a lesson for any cinematographer working not only on big movies, obviously, but even on smaller indie movies. And he just recently did an indie movie, and we talk a little bit about his process with that, how he works with directors, how he sets up his movies. I dug in really deep, and he was so kind to give us almost 90 minutes to answer all the questions I had for him. He was so generous to do so. So get ready for an epic, epic conversation with Russell Carpenter. I'd like to welcome to the show Russell Carpenter, the legendary Russell Carpenter. Thank you so much for being on the show, Russell.
It is a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so, so much. And I'm so glad I ran into you in Cinegear down in L.A.
That's right.
It's amazing what happens when you're here in L.A.
Yeah. Cinegear is the place that you'll constantly be running into anybody you ever met.
You're right. Absolutely. Everybody in the business kind of walks in there and they're walking around like crazy. So I wanted to ask you, let's first start off at the very beginning when you were born. No, I'm joking. How did you get into the film industry in the first place? What made you want to become a cinematographer?
At first it was just play, something to do with my friends. I grew up in the Orange County area, the deepest, darkest, very Republican Orange County. This was about two ice ages ago. When we were playing, we were working with super 8mm cameras, and it was just dumb things to do to keep ourselves occupied, my friends and I. And in fact, my sister, Maureen, who is the sanest of the four of us children, for raising these ugly animals, if you wouldn't say that, called chuckwa. They're desert lizards, and they look like roadkill when they're alive.
Oh my God!
Because I grew up watching things like the original King Kong over and over and over mm-hmm. again, because it was on the local station so much. We decided we would make a monster movie, so we tied we took one of her lizards called a chuckwalla, mm-hmm. and incidentally my best friend in the world was named Chuck Waller, so mm-hmm. string.
That's hilarious.
And so we tied strings to the lizard, thread to the lizard, put plastic paper wings on the lizard, and flew it endlessly back and forth in front of a landscape painting. And that was our first movie called It Came from the Pet Shop.
Oh, that's genius.
We worked our way up from there. So I was afraid at the time. I eventually got out of high school, dodged track by doing AV, TV, audiovisual television mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And at that time, I didn't have the money to go to, USC or UCLA, and I was terrified of those places. They were so big, and
right?
And wicked on my means. And I went to instead went to San Diego State, the State College. San Diego State College at the time became San Diego State University, and I had the supreme luck to get a job at a public television station, very small one. That's where I really actually got to work with 16mm film, and I made every mistake in the world. But at least, I learned these mistakes by doing, and it really gave me an opportunity to, instead of just learn about film in a classroom, learn about it by just going out there and doing it. And I stayed in, I did that for a while until I was offered a job mm-hmm. there. I quickly discovered that I can't really, I had a trouble just going every day to the same job and sitting in a little desk, and I couldn't do it. So mm-hmm. I quit. I went to Hawaii for a while. I lived on tuna fish and peanut butter. Best served together, I found out. And slept on beaches, and I was on a beach north end of Kauai at Kalalau Valley, and one morning I woke up and there were these helicopters descending from the sky, and they were landing on the beach around me.
Uh-huh.
And these guys got out wearing t-shirts, shorts, and they had these cases, and it said Panavision on the side of them. You know, this was out in the middle of nowhere. And it turned out that they were there to film what year was this?
Is this not Hawaii Five-0?
No, it was not. It was the Jessica Lange.
King Kong.
King Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed, I watched this happen, and it just kind of, it was literally a sign from the heavens that maybe I should get back to California and do something. And I got a job at another public television station, and after working there for a couple of years, hooked up with a director, Tom Everhart, who we were both tired of edifying people, and he wanted to make a low budget horror picture. So he convinced this, I would guess, call it an office furniture czar.
Okay. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
To fund our little movie, if this fellow's wife could be like the most prominent zombie in the movie.
Obviously.
And we had to have a plane crash or the remnants of a plane crash in the movie. So we almost burned down somebody's backyard creating that. And miraculously, this little movie was released. Not for like 4 days or something like
sure,
that.
Sure.
That gave me false hope, and I moved not far, but moved north to L.A. And I would call it the starvation started. But I think my false hope was just that, false hope. And I was afraid. My problem was I was just afraid to make phone calls, just
right.
To call people. Mm-hmm. And I realized that lots of other people had. Well, at that time we had 16mm demo reels that we had to, you know, show to people, and we would just, you know, put them in their hands, and then we would wait the 2 to 3 weeks it would take them to actually look at the reel.
Right.
It was a good experience for me. I learned that not to be so afraid. I was still mortified, terrified. Mm-hmm. Eventually, what happened was that friends of mine that I'd been working with in documentaries in North Carolina, they moved up to L.A. and they were starting to do things, and they would get me in on interviews for things. And from there, it was really, Well, I would call it. It was like a lightning fast, mm-hmm. 15 years.
Overnight success.
Yeah, overnight success. 15 years of, you know, just waiting and waiting and waiting for the very next thing to come in. But in the meantime, what I was doing was at that time again, it was like VHS tapes or beta tapes that I would watch the work of. Cinematographers that I really admired, and I watched these things backwards and forwards, and learn from that. That was kind of how I learned. Plus the little time I would have on the set, and I was starting to do the dramatic form stuff, if you could call it that, because it wasn't really dramatic. It was kind of schlock.
Right.
let's just call it like it was. But
sure.
But it got me on a set, and that was the best experience I could have. And I just moved from zero budget to no budget to, you know, slightly, you know, budget movies. And it was much harder to get into the union. So I just kept doing this as I worked my way along.
Basically, you were just grinding it for 15 or 20 years until you started really getting some momentum built up for yourself.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, to people who are in the same position, I just said, if there was one thing besides learning as I went and really going to as many seminars as I could and all that. For me, it became just a matter of persistence. And in one way, it was miserable, but in a waiting. But in the other way, I didn't have anything else I knew how to do. So I kind of had to stick with this, you know, even when it just seemed like grimmer than grim. And so, but eventually I got to a point where I said, I think I can make a living at least doing the independent films. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that happened was that sometimes things would happen that were like sheer disaster, mm-hmm. you know, and they actually led to something where, to a break. Like for instance, I did, 4 episodes of The Wonder Years before I was fired.
And okay. Why were you fired?
Well, a couple reasons. One, I would walk, you know, I would walk into somebody's office. So they say, "Oh, Russell, you know, I want to talk to you about one thing." I said, "You know, the dailies. You know, the film. It's just too bright. You've got to darken it down. We don't want this to play as purely broad comedy." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, I'm thinking, that's not the way I lit it. I don't quite know what they're talking about." And then literally, like, 10 minutes later, somebody said, "Hey, Russell, I want to talk to you about something." They'd take me into their room, and I'd look at their TV set, and they say, "This is the Wonder Year. It's supposed to be brighter. You're lighting it too dark." And I mean, literally.
Oh my God!
And I'm just thinking, oh, I don't think I'm long for this job. And also at that time, and I didn't really understand it. The people who ran the shows, called showrunners, they really wanted the DP to kind of tell the director what to do, because the directors would come in and they were at that time
TV
kind of like TV traffic cops, and the person who really ran the show was the showrunner, and I was coming from the space of the director's the boss,
right?
Whoever he or she is, I'm serving that person, and that really kind of for that show made me the wrong person for the job. So I got fired from that. I didn't know what to do. I was I was doing like these odd job things for. They had this thing called it was a temporary employment agency called Manpower. You know, so we would go and do that. And I would do jobs, like one of the worst jobs I ever had, but it was enlightening, I lasted half a day. I worked at this place that was like this mom and pop liquid vegetable vitamins for your plants.
Okay.
I sat with about 20 other people in a room, and by hand, we put labels on these.
Oh, jeez.
And there was a guy who would walk around and tell us, no, it's down a little to the right, you know, or speed it up or whatever. And it was the most mindless thing you'd ever been. And I asked the guy next to me, I said, "How long have you been here?" And he said, 5 years.
Oh my gosh.
And that was an epiphany. And the epiphany was, wow, you know, there are probably millions of people in the world who have jobs like this. You know, and however miserable it seems at times, I at least have a job that at least when I'm doing it, I really love it. You know, mm-hmm. and it just made me. It didn't really get me over anything except at least have an appreciation for the job. But what happened was I did, like, after that show, I was really running out of money. I took a show I was trying to get out of doing. I was doing a lot of, C or Z level horror movies. Mm-hmm. Did this something I really didn't want to do, It was Pet Sematary 2. And it was, but I had the greatest time. You know, the people were great. The director was great. Mm-hmm. And one of the people who was in that was Eddie Furlong. And he had just not too long ago done Terminator 2. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he was very young. And so, the people who were kind of his on-set guardians said, oh, you know, there's something about you, you get along really well with Jim Cameron.
So before we get to Jim, because I have a bunch of questions about Titanic and your relationship with Jim, I want to take you back a little bit to one of your first films. And I'm just dying to hear what experience it was like and what lessons you learned from shooting Critters 2, The Main Course.
Well, let's see. What did I learn?
Because, I mean, that's the thing. A lot of people only see the Oscar. They only see, not from you, but generally when they see someone successful in the business, they only see the end result of 20, 30 years of grind. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And I that's what I have to say is that for all of that, I mean, there are a few cinematographers in the business who seem to, you know, like rise out of the depths of the ocean, full blown. Full blown cinematographers.
Right.
You know, Janusz Kaminski or Chivo.
Chivo, of course, yeah. Or Vilmos, or one of these guys.
Or Vilmos, and you go, oh my God, they're fully formed, you know, and they're like 14 years old, and they're shooting, you know, these master pieces, and why am I still on the bunny slopes of life, you know, just, yeah, you know, grinding it out, you know, just scooting along. I don't know how the world works, but I do know that if you keep putting out the energy, mm-hmm, eventually, things happen. And I had a great time with Critters 2, and you're just trying to, you know, even though you're looking at your heroes, and at that time I was looking at people like Vittorio Storaro, and yeah, I said, and I'm shooting Critters too, and yet maybe it's something from my hero that I can apply to this, mm-hmm, and add it or try to make the light a little more interesting, and Each thing you do is somehow putting a part of your personal camera together, because we all talk about the gear and stuff like that, but the real gear is the real camera is the camera inside, the one that you're putting together, that you'll be putting together for your whole life, is that. And anytime you get on a set on anything, it's just the most excellent opportunity to not only develop the vision, but to learn how to develop the vision while things are falling apart. Because in a way, on film sets, they always are.
Always. I
mean, because there's usually never enough time. There's usually, I wouldn't call it the daily emergency, but. A lot of things just don't happen the way you imagine they might, especially when you're starting out, because people that you're working with have about the same experience level that one would as a young cinematographer. So I would just take these little things that I could do, and maybe it certainly wasn't every shot, but I'll say, okay, at the end of the day, I could say, but I did some terrific stuff with that shot or that shot or that shot. So it was never a situation where, I felt that I'm good enough to wait for a script. That was not that ideal never happened. It was, I've got to eat, you know,
right,
got to start myself, got to pay the mortgage. Mm-hmm. What can I do to get experience? And I think that was one of the best a person that I know who worked in a lab. He said, you just said, do everything you can do, you know, just do everything you can do. And that turned out the way that worked for me. And, you know, and I have talked to cinematographers and say, no, I will wait until I have a script that I think is worthy of shooting. And that worked for them. But I picked a path that I needed to pick out of necessity, basically.
Now and during that time, you were doing a lot of horror movies like Nightmare on Elm Street and the legendary Puppet Master, which was one of my favorite. I loved that. Must have been such fun shooting Puppet Master.
Well, I did
additional shots, additional stuff,
additional photography. At that time, I would do anything that I could. Working on Nightmare on Elm Street, those films were actually a lot of fun to do. They were really a lot of fun, and they were done in basically warehouses out in the Santa Clarita Valley, kind of, they say, way off the grid. And they were at, I forget what years these were. This must have been the 80s or...
That was 89, yeah.
Yeah, 89. It was, again, it was much, much harder. Let's just say the union has really changed a lot. Now I see the union as much more realistic in terms of their educational programs, and it's not like it's not kind of like life and death just to get into the union. Mm-hmm. But at that time, it was tougher. So those of us who needed a place to paint to do something, that was what we worked on. Things like the New Line, the company that did Nightmare on Elm Street, was a relatively new company, and this was a place that we could work. And then we also, and I also met other cinematographers and filmmakers who I've known forever. My gaffer Len Levine, we met in the 80s, and we've been working on and off together ever since. So that's a long relationship.
Now, and then you also, during that time, you started getting some more action work, and you actually worked on some of my favorite action movies of the late 80s and early 90s, like the classic Death Warrant by Jean-Claude Van Damme, Perfect Weapon, Hard Target.
Yeah, when I look back on the Carpenter Opus, I'm sure Death Warrant will be right up there, because you never had more than three word sentences for the star to say. You know, it was action.
It was
action. Yeah, and plenty of it, and about as mindless as they come. But you know, again,
you were working.
And that was the thing. One thing leading to another. The director of Death Warrant, Darren Zarekin. Mm-hmm. His father was going to do this film, a Japanese sci-fi movie that had at the time a phenomenal budget. I think it was
55 million bucks. I'm looking at it right now. It was a monster budget for its day. Solar Crisis, yeah. Right? Was that called Solar Crisis?
And it turned out to be an unwatchable movie. But I did good work on that film. I was really happy with what I did. And so I went back and I collected bits and pieces. I got this and that. And then I went in and I basically retimed the thing myself to use as my showreel. So here I have my whatever it is. Okay, let's say $55 million showreel. And I didn't know what to do with it. But so I had that. I had something to show. And as you go along, you just have to, because as a cinematographer, you can be the potential cinematographer that you want to be, but you have to show people that you're, in fact, validly a real cinematographer. So that's why it's even if something that you do is the acting's bad or this or that, stories, but somehow you can cobble it together skillfully, either yourself or with the help of an editor, mm-hmm. and you use that to show people. But showing people something that you've done is, that's absolutely paramount, that you have that. So, yeah, I would, yeah.
Now, as far as there was one movie in that time period in the early 90s, Hard Target, which was a big deal back in the day because it was John Woo's first American film. What was it like working with John, and how did that change? Because I know he was used to I think Hard Boiled and The Killer, they shot in like 250 days or something. Like, he just sat and just shot. You didn't have that on Hard Target. How was that relationship to work with on that movie?
That it was amazing. But one, John is one of the nicest people you could ever meet. And
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I said, how is it that this guy is making
shooting the most violent movies ever
that are just mere, they're clever, they're very but you know, there's a lot of blood flying around
and doves,
of course. We had our obligatory dove, I think.
Yes, you did.
It was. I know it was hard on John, in the sense that in America, he said, and he said this to me after the film. He says, one thing I've learned is that in America, celebrity is everything. So he said, celebrities, and at that time, you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Oh, he was huge. He was huge.
Huge, and he said. And therefore, they have a lot more input, not only into how things are shot sometimes, but especially how things are cut afterwards. And he said that was probably one of the reasons he eventually went back and did some of these really great films back in China, was that he was not used to dealing with the political culture in Hollywood. And he was not used to, I mean, really being the god on the set. Not that I'm not saying that in an egotistical way.
No.
I'm saying it in the sense that
vision.
It's the vision,
yeah.
Director vision. And he said if he wanted to do a big action scene with amazing action. He literally have hundreds of people who would want to do this crazy ass stuff that would be very hard to pull off in the United States, like given the regulations that they have here.
Sure,
but the experience of working with him was great, but also learning the way that he shot was very different in terms of how action is staged in the United States. In the United States, you'll take your action and you'll take your moments and you'll shoot in pieces. This piece and here, and then we move to this piece, and it doesn't necessarily have to be shot in order. John would arrange his shots, his action, as though it was a kind of a putting all the springs into a fine Swiss watch. And every little piece of action would lead to another piece and flow into it. And so he, instead of doing all these little pieces, he would make it more of a ballet and make sense as a whole. But in order to do that, and this is where it falls on the cinematographer who's working with John, is that he'll want to do it with seven or eight cameras.
Of course.
And how you get the how you light for that, and then one how it's almost impossible to keep the other camera out of the shot, but somehow you do it. And so we would do these takes, and we'd do them once or twice, and he would have it. It might take us several hours to set these things up, but once it happened, you'd just go, "Oh my God, this shot took us to this camera," and he knows that, okay, he's going to use 2/3 of a second of this shot, which is going to take us to the other angle, and that may last 3 seconds, which will take us to the other angle. It was really amazing.
So then basically instead of doing 7 or 8 different setups, you would work really hard to get everything in one setup, but you basically have done done the scene or done that sequence.
Yeah. And it's harder on the stunt people and the actor, because you have to make it look like every hit connected.
Mm-hmm.
These things had an energy, though, when they were cut together, that was really great. Yeah. So I learned not only a lot about how to shoot for multiple cameras, but I also learned something about, staging.
Editing and flow. Yeah, I mean, even Hard Target, you watch Hard Boiled, you watch The Killer, and then you watch Hard Target, you can tell he's handcuffed a bit. But
yes, yes.
But you can see the woo come out.
Yes, and some of the signature things that he liked to do, we certainly did those. But then you can also tell. I mean, so here, this is a Jean-Claude Van Damme film.
Yes,
but it is. And then you go back and you look at Hard Boiled. And they have a lot. I mean, there's a lot more going on in those films. Yeah, I mean they're amazing. Mm-hmm. So.
They're masterpieces of action. I mean,
you go back and you look at the birdcage scene. And
the opening of Hard Boiled. Oh my God, it's so amazing.
Yeah, you just go, oh my God, what planet did this come from? I mean, they're really amazing films. So So that was a great experience.
So you were starting to talk about how you and Mr. Cameron got together. You were saying that you met, you worked with Eddie for a long after Terminator 2, and his people said, hey, you would work well with Jim?
Yeah, and at the time, he was, Jim wanted to do an independent film.
A drama, that drama that he wanted to do, a thriller or something like that he wanted to do. I heard about that.
It's The Crowded Room. This is a famous film that's never been made, about the life of a person who had like 15 or 16 personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been around Hollywood for, I don't know, eons. And somehow it's never got made. But he wanted to do that. And so Eddie's people and also some other people who knew me, I guess, suggested to Jim that he should meet me. I got there was a party at the end of Pet Sematary 2, and I think he came to that. And we talked for a little while, and I probably had the life force at the time, like a piece of wood or something. It was weird because after that I was in Louisiana, in New Orleans with John Woo, because that film fell apart.
Right.
But what I did do was I did show my $55 million sample reel.
Right, amazing reel, amazing sample reel.
And he liked it. And but the film fell apart. So I thought, well, that's okay. I didn't. I just go back to while doing the John Woo film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really weird. I got this phone call from his producer while I was there when you get back to town, I want you to have lunch with Jim Cameron. He has this project he'd like to talk to you about. So and this is before the internet. So
right.
My crew and I start to get every copy of Variety that we can possibly get. And I'm looking through these varieties trying to see what he has, because in my mind, I'm thinking he's got a little documentary or he's got a something, something little project that he needs a cinematographer.
That's the phone call that at that point in Hollywood history. And to this point as well, you get that call. It's like, hey, Jim Cameron wants to meet you about a project. I'm assuming that's a really big deal.
Well, it was a big deal, but I couldn't put the Russell I knew up to that point in the same room of it's a big feature.
Right.
So I'm looking through these things, and all I can see is he's doing something with Arnold Schwarzenegger called True Lies, and I go right past that because that of course that's not what we're talking about here.
Right.
That couldn't be.
Right. But you couldn't even believe that you would be even up for that situation.
Yeah, but when I got back, exactly. And then when I got back and called his producer up, and the lunch was set up, and it was surreal. We were in near his house in Malibu, and we were sitting down at Tony's Taverna. I guess that's what it was called.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And he starts talking about this film, and it's this Arnold Schwarzenegger thing. I can't, my head is kind of exploding. I can't believe he's talking about this film.
Right.
And this is how Jim hires somebody. So he's starting to talk about the film, and he's talking about this, and like halfway through the conversation, he starts using the word we. And he says, and then when we get to Washington, there are these kind of problems, you know, and then after that, you got to go there and we've got to be ready to do that. And I'm sitting there, you know, like a dog, you know, I can't even, understand. I'm looking at him, but I can't understand.
Surreal, completely surreal.
It was totally surreal. And so we have lunch, and I leave, and I call my agent, and I say, because by that time I had an agent, I said, I think I was just hired to do this big picture. Mm-hmm. And she calls me back 2 days later, and she says, yeah, you knucklehead, you know, yes, you were hired to do the film. And then that opened the Jim Cameron chapter of life. And it was very interesting because the pre-production went really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt like, of course, I felt like I had a lot to prove and stuff like that. And then we started filming, and that went really well too. It was going, oh my God. And just never let this happen to yourself, because this is what I did. I said, well, I don't know what, because I had heard stories about other cinematographers that had worked with him, and they weren't good stories.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm the person who cracked the code.
Oh, no.
Just going so well. And
so all those legendary James Cameron stories, at least on True Lies, didn't happen.
They didn't happen up until about the fourth weekend. and this story I tell a lot because it has something to do with persistence, I guess. And also something to do with the fact that sometimes you've got to develop a tough enough skin that you know that you realize that it's not about you. Because I went out on plenty of interviews, was turned down plenty of times, and you know, you're kind of in the same boat that an actor is. You go out and you're going to meet with a lot of rejection, and you just cannot take that personally. Just go back, just keep doing your thing and hoping the next thing comes along, and eventually it will. Maybe not as fast as you wanted it, but there it is.
Mm-hmm.
But so he had been watching everything at that time on the camera.
Video, okay.
Yeah. And so now we're in we have a screening one night. It's the first time we're in a theater at the gym's screening room. So there are about 40 people in there. They're all department heads. And the film starts to roll and we're watching a scene, and it's a scene where Arnold Schwarzenegger has just returned from his first mission that he was up in the snow. Mm-hmm. And he returns home and he goes over into the room where Jamie Lee Curtis is sleeping, goes over, looks at himself in a mirror as he takes off mm-hmm. his wedding or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so that shot comes on. And it's a little dark, and I think, oh, I'm going to have them do a reprint on this, print it up a few points. And all of a sudden, I look over at Jim, who's sitting beside me, and he's just sitting there shaking his head. I go, Jim, what's wrong? And now he says loud enough so he's sure everybody in the room
can hear. Oh, no.
He says, I have the highest paid actor in this or any parallel universe. I can't see his eyes. I said, Jim, well, I'll just print it up 3 points. I think everything's okay. He says, no, you print this scene up 3 points and you've ruined the mood of the scene. And that loud enough for everybody to hear.
Oh.
So I, from then on, I just want to die because he'd wait a couple more minutes, and then he'd say something about, a shot had come up that was maybe a little overexposed.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd say, where on earth did you learn to read a light meter?
Oh.
Yeah. Louder, And so out there I endured like three more comments like this. And literally, before, they turned on the lights. And, but before the light was all the way up, I think I was out of that room. I just ran out, and I went out to the parking lot and I called my wife and I said, well, I had my run with Jim Cameron. I'm sure this was my last day. I just, aliens were horrible, blah, blah, blah. And I look up and there's the first assistant director and the, and one of the producers, and they're just smiling at me. They're laughing at me.
All right.
And I go, what? And they just say, he does that to everyone. And I said, no. And he said, no. They said, just call. They said, they gave me a name of a couple of the other cinematographers. They said, just call them and listen, talk to them about this.
Mm-hmm.
I did. I talked to Mikhail Solomon, who'd done The Abyss, and he said, well, did he use the line about, where on earth did you learn to, and did he say his grandmother could shoot better than this or, and I said, yeah. And that, I said, okay, I really have to have this credit and I'm going to stick it out. And, there were days that would go fine, and there were days that just felt like somebody hooked me up to two high voltage wires and I was being electrocuted for the entire day, until they called rap. And that was true lies. And that was, if there was ever a trial by fire picture, that was it. For sure.
I studied Jim's career fairly closely in The Abyss. I mean, one of the craziest experiences of all time. And you hear all these stories about him. And I actually knew some people who worked on Avatar and how he's changed over time, but yet still very, very Jim. I wanted to ask you about working
He has changed over time.
I've heard, and this is just again from secondhand. I've heard he softened a bit. He's not as like he would be back in the before Titanic stage, but he's still Jim.
the thing about Jim if one ever gets an opportunity to work with him, or maybe somebody like him who's coming along, is that there's a singularity of vision and almost a laser-like concentration on the scene that he's doing. I mean, I've never seen anybody concentrate like him. And I've never seen anybody working harder than he does on the set. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, how can somebody be that invested second after second? Because the rest – the rest of us mortals seem to say, okay, I just did that. Now I've got a chance to take a breath. Maybe I'll just go over to the craft service table and do this. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to be Jim to me. There's in terms of pure devotion to what he's doing, I've never seen another person like him, you know, in my experience. And that's really something. And my sense about him is that every time he does a project, he goes out and says, there's something I don't know how to do. There's something I've never done. You know, mm-hmm. So with True Lies, it's, well, I've never really shot, you know, a comedy, you know, so I'm going to do a comedy or now here's Titanic and I need to make a film that not only succeeds as an action film, but I've got to make a film that totally succeeds as a love story, or the action's not going to mean very much. Right. And so he says, well, I don't know how to do this film now. I'm finished. You know, right. That's his attitude.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I don't think he expects everybody to be perfect, but I know he expects everybody to be doing the absolute best job they can, that they know how to do.
Now,
that's saying a lot. And I think for the storms that come up, when they do come up, if you learn not to take them personally and know this is going to last another minute and then it's back to work. Then you have a chance of not having a nervous breakdown. You know?
And some people just can't handle that. Some people take it too personally. And in this business, I think is one thing I've learned over the years is you can't take it personally. A lot of times you just can't. You got to move on.
No, you can't take it personally. And then on the other hand, especially as a director of photography, you need to. So if there's angst on the set, you also need to develop the skills that you're not the main source of that angst, or you're doing something to, you know, okay, we all know that things have to be done. They have to try to do them in a certain time, but I think I would mistake my passion when I say, oh, this is just passion. But, you know, in some ways, I'd look back at it and I'd say, oh, that wasn't passion. You were just being an asshole.
There's that.
Yeah. And you can learn to have that passion. And this took a long time to learn. You can learn to have that passion and also have a roaring good time because you're doing one of the best. You're in the position of having one of the best jobs, at least I think, that anybody can have.
Now, when working with a director that's so hands-on, like what advice would you give? What advice would you give to a cinematographer who has a very hands-on director, meaning that he's very involved with the visual look of the film and how it's shooting? He might even tell you a little bit of like, I want this here, because a lot of times you know with Jim and I talked to Mr. Cameron, he's obviously a very technical director and he really knows a lot about what you're doing and pretty much about what everybody else is doing on the set.
And as is probably often quoted, he'll tell people that he knows that. and the whole miserable aspect of that is that he's probably right. You know?
Right. When you're working with a genius, it's you're like,
I would put Jim in that category of being a genius. I think because you, at one point you go, well, how can somebody who's so technical do a movie that's also has so much imagination and the way he paints and how with his camera angles and the structure of his script, he sets up a totally immersive mm-hmm. experience, you know, and that is that to have that technical side and that artistic side all firing, you know, on all cylinders, you know, they're all working, you know, all the, you know, that doesn't happen. With Jim, you you know, and I guess in my personality makeup, I'm a pleaser, and I am that person who says, this is the director's vision. How can I help this director with his or her vision of what she wants? And so you go in. So there's Jim on one end of the spectrum who is just happy to set up and frame every camera, you know. You know, on like a Titanic, it's interesting. Like, as a cinematographer, I had the freedom to do things the way that I thought they should be done. But if I wasn't doing what he wanted, he would definitely let me know. So,
right,
he would say, "No, I want that's not it. I want this." Or I think the light here should be harder or something like that.
So he literally would get that detailed. Like, no, this needs to be – it's like almost like a Kubrick in that sense that has such a complete control of the vision that if he doesn't see you doing what he wants, he will push you or nudge you in the proper direction according to his vision.
But I also tell directors that I know – don't have those chops. You know, they're wonderful people who have come from writing or some other aspect. They say, and especially now it's much, much easier with
digital.
Look, if you see something that for some reason doesn't work for you, just tell me. Unless it's something really, like, really don't agree with. I just said, okay, well, yes, I can do this a little different, and let's see if you're and in a second I'll come back and say that's right. That it's not so much technical. It's just something. It's story driven for most people. So as a cinematographer, you go, okay, on films there are lots of things that are the same, but I've always found every single film to be different, and a lot of that has to do with how you work with a director. I did a lovely film in India called Parched, very low, and the director was fantastic, but we never really, after she told me where she felt the heart of the story was or this particular scene, we didn't really talk about lighting. And in this situation, I would suggest blocking. I would say, okay, given what I just saw, we could do it this way, and this way, and because we're on a budget. And if we do it this way, we tell the story, and we just shave a couple shots off the scene because we're doing it more efficiently. So as a cinematographer, you can be of service in to any kind of director that you're working with. But again, with if it's a Jim Cameron, you know that they're going to have lots of input about things that other directors may not care a bit about. It's very, very flexible business that way.
So let's talk a little bit about that little film, Titanic. That is, you know, we've heard legendary stories about, you know, stories from the set. I knew a few actors on the set that have told me a lot of stories. I mean, at the time, it was the biggest budget film in filmmaking history, in Hollywood history. I mean, you basically had every toy you ever wanted as a cinematographer on set, I'm imagining. Can you tell me what it was like working on a film of that size and also that magnitude? I mean, because everybody in the world was looking at that movie and looking how it would finish and how it would end.
Yeah. For a lot of the your younger listeners who weren't really or certainly weren't reading at that time, the film was such a phenomenon when it was being made that there was actually on the front of Variety, I think there was an outline box with called Titanic Watch, because everybody thought this thing was going to be just ghastly flop, because it was the most expensive movie at the time, and there were occasionally there would be setbacks because things were being tried that had never been tried before.
Right.
And also it was what I call a very special movie in that it was a hybrid movie in the sense that a lot of its heart and soul was with the David Lean epics, you know, Ryan's mm-hmm. Doctor or Dr. Zhivago, or, mm-hmm. you know, those big films that had a beating heart like that. And yet it was using some very, very old techniques. And at the same time, it had the other foot was distinctly in the future in mm-hmm. terms of being done with computer, mm-hmm. Totally cutting edge at that time. You know, when the film was in pre-production, they hadn't really worked out a really viable way to make realistic ocean water.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
There were two things that I would read in the paper, you know, because now it wasn't just the trades, it was the LA Times. One was that things were unsafe on the set, mm-hmm. And that is not true. Mm-hmm. We had sometimes safety meetings that would last up to an hour because we had an international crew, so you had to do all the safety notes in English and then in Spanish because we were in Mexico, and then we had a lot of Hungarian stunt people. But safety was really, really at the top of everybody's agenda, and Jim's too. It's definitely not a, well, you know, people are expendable kind of thing. So whatever, somebody cracks a rib, breaks a leg. You know, mm-hmm. that wasn't it. I didn't. And the other thing was, well, they're just down there every day figuring out how to throw gold bullion into the water. This thing is so expensive, you know. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the case either. You know, people would come down from the studios and try and figure out how to make things be less expensive, and they weren't coming up with solutions either. In fact, the thing was, the film was so big, it was hard for anybody to get a handle on it. And when I came down, the first time I went down there was before to Rosarito Beach. The studio hadn't really been built. It was a work in progress, and there was an excitement about it. It was like, well, this is how the gold rush must have been. You know,
right.
Buildings coming up like, you know, crazy in days. I would go... I was actually working on another movie at the time this was happening, so I'd come down on the weekends, and it's like every weekend, gosh, there's another big building just came up, and there's the tanks are being built, and it was really quite a sense of excitement about it. And then, but what happened was, you know, on a regular film, you have a sense of where everything fits in, and here are the pieces, and you can look at the film as a totality. This film was just so big, you just had to look at it. I did next week, and you're constantly putting out one fire after another. And this doesn't, this set isn't ready. You know, it's like, and I'll just for example, my John Buckley, who was my gaffer on that picture, he went out as the ship was being built, and he was trying to figure out how to cable something
as a Titanic.
Because basically the whole thing is just a huge piece of scaffolding. I mean, a huge piece of scaffolding
on water.
But not much of the ship was ever in water. I mean, that's part of the illusion that the tank parts, most of the tank was just 3 feet deep, just deep enough so a lifeboat could be in the water, and you'd have like 3 inches of clearance at the bottom of the water. you know, it's kind of like being at Disneyland that way. And right. So it was easy to move the lifeboats around. And then much closer to the ship, then the tank was dug much deeper so people could jump off the side of the ship and not land in 3 feet of water. They had to, you mm-hmm. know, have these 20 feet deep there. And I mean, it was this crazy logistic, you know, and this podcast would go on way too long.
No, please. No, we're fine.
How people figured this out. I mean, how things were scheduled, the ship itself mm-hmm. and a lot of the sets were basically engineered the same way cemeteries engineered letting a coffin into the hole. You have cables under the sure. let's say you have cables under the coffin mm-hmm. and then the winches, you unwind the winches and the cable or straps loosen and they start to take the weight of the coffin and it drops into the hole. That is the same thing. That was the same thing as how that huge ship was dropped.
Right.
And also we had sets that had to be dry in for one scene. Let's say take that giant dining room mm-hmm. with all those lights in there. We shot our dry scenes and then a month or two later came back and shot the wet scenes. And we were in that dry set was actually built inside a tank. So
wow.
Now filled up with water and we have to change all of the lights out because they're going to go underwater and they have to stay lit because that's what happened with the lights on the Titanic. So now you're into all kinds of logistical things. So to make it look like the water is rising, which one end of the set would be lowered on straps until the water started to creep in, and then the rest of the set would be lowered to make it look like the water was rising at a pretty fast rate. And then you end the take and you go back to one. But going back to one... To reset everything. And there were times that the set would go into the water and there's chaos happening. You've got hundreds of people and all that, all the silverware, all the tablecloths, they start to float around and we're talking, you know, what, 100 tables or something like yeah. that. They're floating everywhere. So resetting is not an easy thing. Mm. And that was just kind of the story of all the amazing takes at the end of the, at the end of the movie where the ship's going down and hundreds of people are running up and down the ship. That was probably the last film when you saw 300 people running up and down. That
right.
was because 4 years later you'd have not even that long. Along comes Peter Jackson with Lord of the Rings, and he's got thousands of orcs or whatever running around, and they're all computer driven, and so Titanic was really that movie that made the push out of what we call the more classic kind of filmmaking.
So how did you shoot? Like, how do you shoot a film of that size? Like, just on a technical standpoint, the massive amount. How big was your camera department?
It that would depend on what we were shooting. We started off with the smaller film, smaller scenes, and we'd have one or two cameras, and that was it. And we'd go along that way for a while. And then when we got to the really big stuff, for the cinematographer, for everybody, that's when the craziness happens, is you've got... Jim would say, "Hey, you know what? Let's go outside tonight. I want to see the whole ship." And and we're going, we weren't even scheduled to do this for like 3 more days, and we're not even sure that we can get everything up and running. Because
right.
just going back to how, when you talk about the immensity, we wound up with something like 40 miles of cable inside the ship. And the ship... When you go around, when you look to the other side, all it is it's
scaffolding.
Right. And one side of it has what looks like a ship on it, and only the two top decks of the ship are built along the real ship, and the smokestacks and stuff like that. And so, going back to my gaffer, when we're talking about the immensity of things, he says, he comes back one day and he says, well, we're going to start out with, we need 1,500 lights.
And Jesus.
That's exactly.
Jesus. What kind of lights are we talking about? Like lights? Like film lights?
He said, well, we counted the portholes, and we've got 750 portholes.
Oh, Jesus.
So we need what we call a visible light that the camera can see that looks like it should belong there. And then we want we should have at least a 1K pointed out of every porthole. Okay. And so we've done the portholes, and we're up to 1,500 lights. So he starts to put his list together, and his list goes to 20th Century Fox.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And John gets a little letter back, a little note it's a very nice note, but the subtext is, you're insane. You don't know what you're doing. We're going to send down some people who are going to help you figure out how many lights you need.
Okay.
They do that. So they go up. So they go out with John. This is in pre-production.
Yeah.
One day. They come back at the end of the day, and these guys say, you don't have enough lights. You need more lights. And they were right. And I have to hand it to 20th Century Fox. They found lights. They went to warehouses. They found, you know, and they refurbished a bunch of lights. Because at the end of the day, you have those 1,500 lights just for the portholes.
Mm-hmm.
You have and a lot of them have to be sealed because they go underwater.
Right.
And then you have all the lights and all the sets for the whole movie. And now the number is slipping my mind, but we had a phenomenal amount of lights, not only decorative lights, but lights that we had to use, ranging from everything from the huge lights that kind of light the ship at night,
mm-hmm.
to everything we needed to make the movie, because you can't. You have to have your lights hidden and clustered, because you can't just say, oh, I need a 5K and move it from the stern to the bow, which is 800 feet away. You know, that's not going to work. So, to John Buckley's credit, I mean, it was just an enormous undertaking to do this. And but the number of lights was in the thousands. The cabling for this thing, which looked like it's like if you ever saw that movie Brazil by Terry Gilliam.
Sure.
It looked like a Terry Gilliam version of the telephone company in the 50s. I mean, it was a complete cluster, whatever, of cabling. And how it all stayed on, I'll never know. And it was a constant battle because lights... You know, they're lights, and they go off, you know?
Right. God's 1,500. My mind hurts. My brain is hurting thinking about trying to keep track of a shot, because there was no high-end visual. I guess they could have done something in visual effects, but like, you want 1,500, like 700 and something portals. You're in the middle of a shot. One of the lights goes out. Like, oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. And, boy, and we learned our lesson the first night, because we we had a lot of people back there, in the scaffolding area. But because it was the first night, and I think we were shooting a couple of days earlier,
mm-hmm.
John would see some lights go out, or worse, Jim would see some lights out, and he says, "What are those lights doing out?" And you'd look over, and you hadn't noticed. I mean, oh my God, yeah. And so John would say, "Get somebody down to so and so and so and so." And this is God honest truth. So somebody would run back there.
Mm-hmm.
And And eventually you'd see the lights go on. And then about 3 minutes later, we'd hear, you know, this is so-and-so. I'm down here. I don't know where I am. I can't find my way out. You know, would somebody please come and get me? Because I'm really starting to get nervous. You know,
God.
I realized that we would have to play a zone system from then on. And the same person, we put everything in quadrants. So, like, going up, you had level, you'd have level, A, B, C, D, you know, all the way to whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then horizontally, you'd have a number. So every quadrant, and we'd have the same person, boring as this is, work the same fairly small quadrant night after night, because that is that was the only way we could do this efficiently. But that looking back now, it seems funny, but when you're waiting, when the director is waiting, it wasn't so funny.
I mean, it's honestly, it's a miracle that no one got hurt.
Yeah, I think in construction, like somebody
stunt. Oh, really?
Yeah, and we did have somebody else got hit by a car walking along the road down there. That wasn't on the set,
right?
And then that we had one big night that had been rehearsed for weeks, where at the end of the movie, the stern of the ship goes near vertical.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
people start falling down.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, and they were, what they were falling down into was a bunch of stunt pads covered in green, so we could extend the ship to make it look longer. And they had it all worked out. So the timing, so one person would fall, and they were, when I say fall, they were all on these things, these descender fan mm-hmm. rigs that would slow the fall down. It would still look real, but it would, you know, they weren't literally falling, they were under control. But they had to get out of the harness and then jump out of the pad, you know, not get out of the harness, but disconnect and
right.
jump. But on the first two takes, in the excitement of it all, like, some people weren't getting out of the way, so the next person down, like, somebody cracked a rib and
right.
somebody landed. And Jim just said, hey, we're not doing this anymore. So more people, somebody's going to really get hurt. And so we came back later, and the really significant falls, they were done by
CG.
CG, yeah. CG based on a real person doing a fall. That then became a CG person.
He was cutting edge, because there was nothing like that at that point. There was nothing like that at that point.
Yeah. And if you look back at it now, you know, you could, yeah, you can pick certain things apart and go, well, that person's not quite walking right. That must have been.
Yeah. My favorite spoof, or the biggest mistake I've saw in Titanic, if I could be so bold as to call something out, was when Jack's running down the hall while the water's rushing behind him and Rose, and you see the face that they face replaced the stunt people. And you could, that's the only really, like, blaring visual effect shot that was like, ah.
Yeah, that was the one where, you know, he really tried to make that work. And I guess, you know.
He pushed the technology too far.
Yeah. And now face replacement is commonplace. But at that time.
Now there's one more question about Titanic I had, and this is I read an American Cinematographer magazine article years ago that I think you gave about the wide shot of the ship sinking into the water, that the bulbs, because they were hot, the bulbs on the actual deck, not like film movies lights, but actual lights, practicals, would hit the water and they would pop. So then after you would reset, you would have someone go in there and have to unscrew and screw back in new lights. Is that true? Or is that something, some truth?
Here's the timing on all of the scenes where that started out basically looking dry and then sinking into the water. Timing was of the essence, because let's just take the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
Dining room when we shot all the dry for dry scenes, like dinners and stuff like that. Basically normal lights. Mm-hmm. But when that same set was going to sink into the water, all the bulbs had to be enclosed in a glass fitting. They had to be watertight, because as soon as water hit any of these bulbs, they would explode.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Also, if they just stayed on, eventually the heat would build up inside that airtight container, and it would explode because of the heat.
Jesus.
So what we had to do was, and again, because we had so many people in these scenes, we would work and rehearse and rehearse and rehearse, get all of our cameras set up. Then you would do, and this was just a common thing, especially with sinking things, you'd have to do a set search with divers going down the set
to make sure
there was nothing, and there was nobody down there who had been left behind. Somebody who hadn't heard the, we're going to shoot, you got to.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So that would be time consuming too. So awesome. So you're looking at another 20 minutes just to do that. Then the real action, once you call action, the real action has to happen within, was it a minute and a half? Mm-hmm. So, because as soon as you roll cameras, when the lights come on, you roll cameras, and then you know that about a minute and a half from now, these lights have to be underwater or they're going to explode. So that's the timing issue of it all. Is there was this kind of this 1.5 or 2 minute drill, mm-hmm. that thing had to happen so that the lights would go underwater. But inevitably, if you say, let's just say 100 lights. Okay, you go for take two. 7 of those lights have gone out. So we had a team that would run in, grab those lights, and then replace them with lights that were working. That part didn't take us, because we were prepared for that, mm-hmm. that didn't take as long as it might have.
Wow. Now what, and I know you've given me so much of your time today, Russell. Thank you so much. I have a few more questions if you're game.
Sure.
All right. What is the biggest lesson you learned from shooting Titanic? Because it was unlike an experience that most cinematographers will ever have.
Yes, in fact, my crew, who worked with me for a long time, said, "Yeah, gee, Russ, when are we ever going to do this big movie?" And
be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, that's right. After Titanic, at the end of the day, the last day. They called rap, and instead of a big whoopee, yay, we did it.
Yeah.
People like zombies just wandered to the parking lot, got into their cars, and drove away.
broken souls.
Broken spirits, yeah. God, the biggest lesson was on a film like that big, you can't be overwhelmed by trying to gobble up the whole experience all at once. If then you'd never start. You just,
right.
For me, it was, okay, I've got this scene. I'm going to do the best I can on this scene this day. And I know I've got a group of really good people who are working on the sets that we're going to shoot, you know, a week from now or 2 weeks from now. To really just hang in there and do your very best that you can with what's in front of you. And that was the only way I got through it.
Yeah, because if you try to eat the entire cake, you'll never get through. You have to take it bite by bite, slice by slice, day by day.
Yeah.
Now, what's the biggest mistake you see young cinematographers make?
Well, because because I've seen a lot of really great young cinematographers, and I don't know what else is happening out there. I think, gosh, the only thing I think is there was a value in shooting film that you really had to know your stuff, what you can do with exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that I'm hearing from the labs is that sometimes people shoot thinking that they can fix everything when they get into the, you know, the post-production process.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, and I can't say that I've seen, because I've never seen that, but the labs have, and they say, don't these people know that their film could look so much better if they really paid attention to the lighting of this actress or this actor, and try to do as much of the work on the day while you're shooting, and then also because you have a very good, then if you have a very good sense of what can be done and should be done in post, you can say, you know what, that wall over there is too bright right now, but I know it's going to take me 15 minutes to fix that now, and I can do it in 30 seconds in post. You can just in that kind of knowledge would be a big help. I think.
All right, that's very very good advice. Now, what would you, on a business standpoint, a film business standpoint, what advice would you give a cinematographer wanting to break into the business?
Besides the thick skin and knowing, hey, you've got to be in this for the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the first two things. There's so many things. Just learning to work with people.
Mm-hmm.
That's such a, because lots of people are really good at what they do, and they're not good at the people end of it. I would say the cinematographer, even though you just want to be an artist, the cinematographer has to be an artist, of course, but a scientist, enough to know what the camera that he or she is working with can do, what it's capable of. You also have to be a manager, because as you go along, you're going to have to start to manage how your people, your weapons are, how they're positioned. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of who's doing what, so you're getting the most efficient use of them. And then a politician, and I mean not so much in the smarmy sense of that we often think of, but it is a political business. When I shoot a test with an actor or an actress, part of what I'm doing there, I mean, at the screen test, is not only learning what I need to know, but really imparting to that actor or actress that I will have their best interest at heart. I want to make, politically, I want them to be comfortable to know that the set for them is going to be a safe place where they can do their best work. So there's that politics. Political in the sense that somebody did a bonehead thing.
Mm-hmm.
Who did a bonehead thing? And instead of yelling at them, no, people make mistakes. This person was trying to do their best job.
Mm-hmm.
My only grief with people is if the biggest issue I have is that I know somebody's very competent and they're just not trying.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big issue for me. But so anyway, there are so many things you've got to be able to do and make art while catastrophe is happening around you. And that's the other thing. So in a nutshell, those are the things that I'd pay attention to if I was going to.
Now, I'm going to ask you the last few questions that I ask all my guests. Can you tell me what book had the biggest impact on your life or career?
Holy cow.
these are heavy questions.
I don't even know if I have an answer for you right now. What book? I don't have an answer for that.
All right. Well, then we'll move on to the next question. It's okay. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in life or in the film business?
In life and the film business, because it seems like whatever we choose to do in life, there are other lessons that we're here. It seems to me we have to learn. Mm-hmm. One is, say, as passionate as I am, or as fast as I want to go, or whatever, as good as I want the picture to look, I have to have empathy for what anybody on the set is going through. I mean, I think developing empathy that somebody might be at work and they might be coming off a very, very tumultuous home life, mm-hmm. or they're working maybe they're working with some injury that's healing, or mm-hmm. Or just that I could say something. I don't think it happens much now, but I could certainly see it happening early on. You say something that's meant to be a joke, and yet it cuts to the quick with somebody, and you just have to have. Just trying to, again, have the empathy of what it's like to be another person on the set working, you know, having to work with me. What is that experience like?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. The excellent, excellent answer. And what are three of your favorite films of all time?
Oh, my God.
And pick anything that comes to mind.
Okay. Just for the look of it, Red, Searching for Bobby Fischer, because I love the story. I love the way it was shot. There's so many. the three.
Searching for Bobby Fischer is such a – that is like a DP's movie, isn't it? What he did and the name – I'm sorry. Please forgive me the name.
Conrad Hall.
Oh, yes, Conrad Hall. What he did with – like he was shooting with mirrors and he was – what he did in that movie for cinema on a cinematography standpoint is remarkable, right?
Yeah. And just the guts it took to do some of the things that he did. But how beautiful that film looked and how it was shot. The camera was placed because a lot of the time in that film, you really are putting yourself in the place of this very young, I guess, like 11 years old, mm-hmm. chess. Mm-hmm. And that was great. Oh, God, there's so many more films. And, oh, you know, Red Shoes, which a lot of people.
Oh, of course. See. Yes.
Red Shoes is just, I thought that was a.
Stunning.
A stunning film and a marvel of the Technicolor process. And I probably got
100 more probably.
Yeah, those, right now, right here, that's what comes to mind. Yeah.
And last question, what was it like winning the Oscar?
I have been asked that, and I think it's a for me, it was really weird. I found out it's all about the dress, you know, my wife's dress, what she was going to wear. Mm-hmm. It was at that point, I was not, I think I was so serious. I didn't really allow myself to feel the joy, the kind of kick in the pants that must be. Mm-hmm. And what happened was I won the Oscar, mm-hmm. and then within 8 hours later, I was in the hospital. Same night, I passed a kidney stone. No, I didn't pass, but I had a kidney stone, and I was in such agony.
So you really couldn't relish in the achievement.
Yeah. So it was like, yeah. But it's really weird. Like right now, I feel like I'm enjoying what passes for a career as a much, much more. I'm having much, much more fun on the set, appreciating mm-hmm. people a lot more, and I have I would say a little bit, or maybe a considerable amount more of tranquility because early on, I was just so nervous about, you know, how things were going or not going. Mm-hmm. And now I look back and I say, yeah, well, like right now I'm going through a period where nobody seems to be calling. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going through a period where too many people have called and I, or whatever. I can take what's kind of on the plate with a more ease than I did before.
Russell, I want to thank you so much for your time and amazing stories and amazing advice you're giving our listeners. Thank you again so much for being here.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
That interview does not disappoint. Russell, again, is so amazing. And thank you, Russell, so much for taking the time out. I know you literally just got back from Bali and heading over to Vancouver, and you had 2 days to rest, and you took an hour and a half of that time to speak to me. So thank you again. And I hope you guys got a lot out of that interview. It was just such a thrill for me to sit down and talk to Russell and to pick his brain about his process and his firsthand experience of working on some of the biggest movies of all time, working with the biggest directors and filmmakers of our generation. So it was such a pleasure and humbling experience doing this. So I hope you guys got a lot out of it. I know I did. I got really jacked up and really inspired and I kind of start shooting again, but there'll be more on that later. But anyway, guys, thanks again for listening. If you want to see anything we talked about in the show, head over to our show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/179. This is a long one, so I'll keep it short. Keep that hustle going. Keep a dream alive, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.